This is Eva Hearn. Welcome to the Healing of Agape this week. This week we have an interesting fellow named Dr. Matthew Burke, who used to practice anesthesiology at UAB Hospital, and now he's changed from that to alternative medicine, and we're going to hear why now. Hello, Matthew. How are you?
Hi, Eva. I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, thanks. So tell us a little bit, first of all, a little bit about your background.
Well, as you have alluded to, I'm an anesthesiologist. I did my residency at UAB, and then I practiced anesthesia for many years after that. And through the course of my experience in treating pain management patients, I learned of natural and nutritional medicine, alternative techniques that were not taught in medical school that seemed to work a whole lot better than the conventional medical model. And so a great deal of my practice is focused on, rather than treating the symptoms of disease, trying to find the root cause of disease and removing that and allowing the patient's body to heal itself.
And where do you do your work, Matthew?
Well, I'm my office is in Venice, Florida.
And if somebody wanted to come see you, where would they call or come and see you?
Well, they would call my office and book an appointment at 941-488-8112.
Do you have a website?
No, I don't.
Okay. So tell me, if somebody had, say, chronic back problems that were soft tissue in nature, what would you do?
Well, generally, chronic back problems that we know are soft tissue related are related to weakness in the strength of the ligaments and tendons that support the bony structures in the back. If you think of the back and the pelvis as being supported, such as the way a suspension bridge is, you'll realize that a great deal of the strength and ability of the back to function in the way it does, comes from the soft tissue connectors. If those become weakened, then that can be elicited in pain with movement, et cetera. And we use a technique, an injection technique, in addition to natural nutritional supplementation and proper diet.
And what would that be?
Et cetera.
What kind of
the injection technique is called prolotherapy. And that's a term that is shortening of the words proliferative therapy. What the injections are designed to do is deposit a simple mixture of sugar water and a local anesthetic at the site of the weakened tendons or ligaments, and then that will induce the body to have a mild inflammatory response, which, as you know, is part of the healing process that naturally occurs whenever there's injury. That mild inflammatory process causes a strengthening of the tendons and ligaments and a healing in that area.
Now, just out of curiosity, you know, I'm a medical intuitive, and in my readings, people that have soft tissue back injuries tend to have lack of emotional support issues. Have you noticed that in any of your patients?
Well, some, although we don't delve into that side of the patient as deeply as you might.
What supplements would you advise someone to take to help that problem?
Well, it depends on the nature of the soft tissue injury. For somebody that is having just a ligament and tendon problems, then we recommend vitamin C, zinc, and proline, basically, because of those are the elements that will help with regenerating ligament and tendon repair,
okay,
along with a multivitamin, multimineral that contains some copper and some boron.
Now, does it matter to you if the supplements that they take are natural or laboratory supplements?
Well, obviously, we would prefer natural supplements.
Is there a reason for that?
Well, yes. A naturally occurring supplement is going to be much more effective than a man-made supplement. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that man can improve on what God does, And in the interest of expense, people will go after, for instance, the cheapest supplement. But man-made supplements tend to not have the same punch or effect. For instance, some may not be absorbed as well. In the case of vitamin E, for instance, which is very critical, a natural supplement would contain mixed tocopherols, the different types of vitamin E. A man-made supplement is going to contain D-alpha tocopherol, which is just the one type of vitamin E and is very substandard compared to the natural.
That makes such perfect sense, Dr. Burke. What about if someone had coronary artery disease, which is so prevalent?
Well, we recommend different things for that. In a large part, that is caused by diet. And so, of course, the first thing that we do is recommend a change in the patient's diet, not as a diet per se, but a change in their lifestyle. We try to educate the patient and get them on board with regard to taking responsibility for themselves and that right. But to reverse plaque itself, I haven't seen anything work as rapidly or as well as chelation therapy, which is an IV therapy involving a synthetic amino acid called EDTA.
I have a question there. Why would you use a synthetic as opposed to a natural?
We actually use a combination of vitamins and minerals, which are natural, and then the synthetic. You know, it's one of those things where people are trying to do something else and they serendipitously discover something that works. And although in alternative medicine and natural nutritional therapy, we do try to go for the natural technique, we still believe what we see. And so if we see something such as a synthetic that is not harmful, that does work well, then we go ahead and use it. And in the case of EDTA, what happened was, somebody was looking for a way to chelate or bind a heavy metal toxin, lead, in a battery factory workers. And they found EDTA would bind the lead. And they did experiments and showed that the infusion of the EDTA was not harmful if the doses were kept low enough, and it would help eradicate the lead from the system. Mm-hmm. But they also found that these people had a significant amount of, or the ones that had coronary artery disease had a dramatic improvement in their coronary artery disease that would completely recover from their angina.
Interesting.
And so they began doing experiments in people with coronary artery disease, and lo and behold, these originated in Germany. Lo and behold, these people would improve rapidly and dramatically.
Well, now I have another question. I always go back to my medical intuitions because I believe that you are your emotions. When I do my readings about people that have heart disease, I always hear in my head that they have love and hate issues, and that those love and hate issues, when they get these feelings, it causes antigens to be produced. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, I don't understand how A would get to B, but it doesn't have to make sense. Again, there are a lot of mysteries out there, Eva, but they're there and they are consistent and they work. And although I don't understand exactly how some of these emotional states can lead to different physical problems, I am aware that that's true. And even modern conventional medicine will teach you that probably 70 or 80% of maladies out there are related to psychological and emotional problems.
Have you happened to notice if any of your heart patients like that have love and hate issues in their lives?
Not specifically.
Is that
but
something you inquire at?
No,
okay.
It is not. They're coming to me because they're in trouble with their heart. And you have to understand, patients are coming from a conventional mindset. They have been taught that either it's physical or it's mental. And if you start saying, well, you know, let's look into the mental side, then you run the risk of turning that patient off with regard to a physical therapy or medical therapy that may help them. I don't specifically ask people about this issue or that issue. I do ask them to address their stress issues.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that, you know, stress and emotional problems that come from anger and unforgiveness can cause definite physical problems. And I do ask my patients to, you know, to look inward and consider those things, especially if I sense that. And, yes, I have patients that I sense that they have unforgiveness issues or anger issues, and I ask them to address those things.
What supplements would you advise someone to take if they have coronary artery disease? What can they do themselves at home? Particularly, the majority of the people we have to face that have little money.
Right.
You know, we're almost into two classes here now in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them don't have any money. So what could they do at home with supplements that would help coronary artery disease?
Okay, well, first, again, let's start with the basics, what they can do.
Okay.
That doesn't cost them any money. Eat less and move more. Eat less and move more. The other thing they can do is they can eat more of a paleolithic-type diet, which are just basic lean meats and vegetables and a few nuts and seeds, and a whole lot less of the high-fat, high-carbohydrate diet that people have gotten used to eating.
Now, would you think it makes any difference? You know, I've heard that when you cook vegetables, say, over 110 degrees, that it destroys some of the nutritional value. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, it's much more important. It's much better to eat 60 to 70% of your vegetables and fruits raw. The reason is you preserve the vegetables and, vitamins and minerals that may be in those vegetables and fruits, and you preserve the enzymes. Enzymes are what cause the vegetable or the fruit to break down, or we would say rot, but the enzymes that go in with the foods make them easier to digest and are also important in helping the body itself heal itself, and those mm-hmm. raw foods enzymes are extremely beneficial if taken in sufficient quantities. They are anti-inflammatory, and as you may be aware, atherosclerosis or coronary artery disease is an inflammatory type process.
I didn't realize that.
And
so basically, if you cook your food to death, you're basically cooking away your nutrition.
Exactly. That's true. And then from there, I would go to, there's a basic regimen that we recommend to our patients. And you have to understand that even if a patient is, you know, does not have lots of funds to spend on nutrients, supplements, et cetera, they're going to wind up spending those funds on medical care.
Isn't that the truth?
And patients can actually help themselves a great deal more by spending their money on things such as vitamin C. Linus Pauling showed that you could reverse coronary artery disease with a large amount of vitamin C in divided doses along with lysine, which is a simple amino acid. It's cheap. It's easy to get a hold of. It's easy to take.
What dosages would you recommend?
Vitamin C, 1,000 milligrams three times a day. If a person has trouble with upset stomach problems from regular ascorbic acid, which is cheap and easy to find, then they can go to buffered vitamin C. It's not that much more expensive. They don't have to do the more expensive types like ester C, but they can just find the buffered vitamin C. But at least 1,000 milligrams three times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then lysine is an amino acid that you can buy at the health food store. And I would recommend 500 milligrams of that on an empty stomach three times a day if the coronary artery disease is sufficient. Another supplement that can be quite useful is lecithin, which contains a large amount of phosphatidyl choline, which is a type of oil or fat that can help to reduce the plaque.
What about that? I've heard a lot of talk about CoQ10 or coenzyme Q10. I can't remember exactly how it's stated.
Coenzyme Q10 is very, very important. And coenzyme Q10, this is one of those medical paradoxes that I can't understand how even conventionally minded doctors get sucked into this. But coenzyme Q10 is very important for heart function in keeping the strength of the muscle of the heart viable or strong. And it also is important in regular muscles as well. Coenzyme Q10, supplementation with coenzyme Q10 can result in the reversal of congestive heart failure.
That was my next question. Well, so why don't doctors give them that?
Because they're ignorant of the importance of it and how it can be easily depleted. But the diet that generally that cardiologists recommend for people who have coronary artery disease is a low-fat diet, which means that their meats are cut out. Coenzyme Q10 is found in red meat. And so the diet
is... that the only place you can find it naturally?
There may be some fish-type products, and there may be some nut-type products that you can get it. But in any quantity, red meat is a very good source. But cardiologists recommend that patients not take red meat. Then when they find the patients have elevated cholesterol, which is one of their focuses for treating heart disease, they will put the patient on something like Lipitor to block the production of cholesterol.
Which is really bad for you, isn't it?
Well, Lipitor causes a reduction in the production of coenzyme Q10 in the body and blocks the effectiveness of the coenzyme Q10. So that now somebody that has a propensity for developing high blood pressure or congestive heart failure or some of the other muscle-related problems has an even greater risk for developing those problems because of a medication that the physician has placed them on. So, yes, we do recommend patients take coenzyme Q10. If there are significant health problems there, that needs to be probably at least 200 or 300 milligrams a day in divided doses.
You just raised another question, high blood pressure.
Uh-huh.
What could somebody do to prevent that naturally? Because so many people have it. And then they develop kidney problems. So what could they do to address that?
Okay, well, high blood pressure can occur from many things. One, and generally occurs from a combination of things. One thing that is a common contributor to high blood pressure is the lack of proper minerals. Magnesium, for instance, is a very common deficiency in America because we just don't have it in our water anymore. Water systems generally are treated and the magnesium is taken out, and patients don't get the magnesium that they need. So we put all patients on magnesium supplementation. And that's in the form of magnesium citrate, which is absorbable. We have them take it in the morning on an empty stomach.
Now, the first thing somebody does when the doctor finds out you have high blood pressure is put you on a diuretic. So that means you urinate out all of the nutrients that you do have, and they forget to tell you to take that magnesium and that potassium.
Correct, but that's not the first thing that I do. What I do is I ask the patient to take the magnesium. I ask them to take a moderate amount of calcium, 500 to 1,000 milligrams a day, along with the magnesium.
And how much magnesium would you say?
4 to 500 milligrams,
okay,
which would be 2 capsules or tablets, or 1 ounce of the magnesium citrate liquid on an empty stomach in the morning. I ask them to take calcium, 500 milligrams, as much as 3 times a day, and that's in the form of calcium citrate. I also ask them to take a potassium supplement. And again, we always check their lab values, their electrolytes, to make sure that they're okay before we're recommending this. And we take into consideration any medications they may be on, because some people are on medications that actually you would not want to put them on a potassium supplement, as it would raise it too high.
What kind of supplements would that be? I mean, what kind of medications would that be? So people would know not to mix.
Some of what are called the ACE inhibitors, and it's just a class of medication. People need to check with their physician before they start taking supplements if they're already on heart or high blood pressure medications. But the ACE inhibitors are what we're talking about there.
What are ACE inhibitors?
They block the production of aldosterone, which is a hormone that causes the conservation or the retention of salt, sodium, in the body. And that causes a person to retain fluid, and it also causes their blood vessels to tighten down. So the aldosterone production can cause high blood pressure. The ACE inhibitors block that production.
So what the natural thing to take would be the magnesium for that salt retention?
It would be magnesium, potassium, and calcium.
Okay. Now, what about when you know, most people that I know that have heart problems start taking these laboratory pharmaceuticals, then they start having kidney failure. What could they do for kidney problems?
Well, if the medication is the cause of the kidney problem, obviously the first thing to do is to not take that medication. But the other thing is, again, to make sure that these nutrients that we were just talking about, the magnesium, potassium, calcium, are okay. Make sure that they're getting plenty of fluid so that the kidneys are, and I mean water, drinking water.
That's what I was about to say. We're 70-something percent water, aren't we? So why somebody thinks we can urinate it out and not replace it, I don't understand.
Well, correct.
Doctors forget that.
Again, we get back to diet. And people are in the habit of drinking sodas and those types of things. And sodas are high in salts and high in sugar and high in caffeine generally and high in phosphates. Those all are detrimental to the kidneys. So we also ask people to be aware of their diet. A more vegetable-based diet, raw vegetables and fruits, has a higher amount of magnesium and potassium in it. It tends to help lower that. An increased amount of fiber is another thing that's helpful, surprisingly, in lowering the blood pressure. Fiber tends to help the GI tract to function much more efficiently and will also result in for instance, two carrots a day, a healthy male that develops a moderate amount of hypertension, eating two carrots a day, just that little amount of fiber can lower his blood pressure 10 or 15%.
Are you serious?
Yes.
That's so amazing.
So
fiber, not non-cooked carrots, right?
Right. So fiber is important. And then the other thing in blood pressure is that being overweight at all will help to increase the blood pressure. So, again, we ask patients, eat less, move more.
What about people who developed diabetes? What could they do to help that?
Well, first of all, people do not have to develop type 2 diabetes.
Describe type 2 for an idiot like me. I don't know the difference.
Well, type 1 is the primary diabetes that occurs and is commonly referred to as juvenile onset diabetes, and that it results from the lack of the islets of Langerhans, which are the pancreatic cells responsible for the production of insulin. And so it is the body's inability to produce insulin to regulate sugar in the body. That's type 1. Type 2 comes about later in life, and it's a totally different scenario. If you eat sugar by itself, you get a massive and rapid increase in insulin. Insulin is a pro-inflammatory, pro-fat-producing hormone, and it causes people to retain fat and hold on to fat. It also causes tremendous hunger pains. so that if you get in the habit of eating sugar or white foods such as breads, pastas, pastries, those types of things, you will have a chronically elevated insulin level. Chronically elevated insulin level leads to nothing but an increase in the amount of fat, high blood pressure, and inflammation. So you get more chronic diseases such as bone and joint pains, muscle problems, coronary artery disease, et cetera, et cetera.
Interesting. So what are
they
years
and years of increased carbohydrate intake causing chronic elevation of insulin level leads to the problems that we just talked about, hypertension, being fat, atherosclerosis, et cetera, et cetera. That's called metabolic syndrome or syndrome X.
Mm-hmm.
And that occurs for years before patients get into trouble with, now, from a chronic overproduction of insulin, the body is no longer able to keep up with the huge amounts of insulin that are required to regulate sugar control.
Now, I know that that's kind of a silent kind of disease. Does it produce some kind of symptom in their body that they can watch for?
Yes. Hypertension, obesity, and these diseases that we talked about inflammation. Atherosclerosis is one. The other thing that it can cause are neuropathy, where the patient has nerve problems and is having trouble with sensation in their feet or maybe pain in their feet. It can cause visual problems, and it can cause the problems with the kidneys. And you were asking me before about the kidneys. When we start finding that, then we immediately go back and start checking for things like metabolic syndrome and start attempting to correct those.
And how would you do that naturally?
First place to start is diet. And generally, I always recommend that patients be very cautious about doing what I'm about to say for that diet, because they can cause a rapid decline in their glucose levels. And
what would those symptoms be if someone were to do that, so they would know
that would be the symptoms of insulin shock. You mean if their glucose levels decline rapidly?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would be the symptoms of insulin shock. You know, slurred speech, having trouble staying awake, nausea, shakiness,
okay,
et cetera, et cetera. But what we have them do is go to a very low carbohydrate type diet, more of a paleo type diet, as I was alluding to earlier, with small portions of lean meat, fish, chicken, some of raw nuts, and vegetables and fruit in small amounts.
Now, you just brought up another question that I have. People think that when you say nuts that they can go down to their local grocery store and buy a package of salted peanuts. That's not the same, is it? Because those are cooked and some of the nutritional value is taken away, right?
Absolutely.
So it must be raw.
Must be raw. A paleo diet generally is a low-fat, low simple sugar diet. It has complex carbohydrates as opposed to the Atkins diet. It does have complex carbohydrates. You're going to find those in vegetables and fruits, but those are not broken down in the same way by the body and absorbed to cause a rapid rise in sugar in the gut or in the bloodstream.
For people who don't know, what do you mean by a complex carbohydrate?
I'm speaking of the a carbohydrate is simply a molecule that is made up of individual sugars. If it's a very complex carbohydrate, so that there are lots of sugars involved that are not broken down well by the body, then it's a more complex type carbohydrate that cannot be made into sugar that's rapidly absorbed into the bloodstream.
What kind of foods would that be?
Vegetables and non-sugary raw fruit.
Okay. Now, another problem that seems to be prevalent today is colon cancer, particularly in men. What could they do?
They could take colon cancers from a low-fiber type diet, and they can eat more fiber and more of the things that have some of the anti-cancer type, we call them phyto, which means comes from plant nutrients, such as broccoli. Broccoli specifically, broccoli and the other foods in that class. Broccoli comes from the brassica class of foods, and that includes cauliflower and cabbage.
Okay.
Those foods contain several compounds that are anti-cancer specifically and help to prevent cancer.
What kind of supplements would you recommend for them?
For men who are at risk for cancer?
Mm-hmm. Colon cancer in particular.
Well, they can obtain some of the anti-cancer type phytonutrients in supplement form, such as indole-3-carbamol, I-3-C. You can obtain that by name at the health food store.
Okay.
And there's another one that is related to it called DIMM, D-I-M-M. And those have a specific anti-cancer effect with regard to colon cancer. They probably should also take an increased amount of calcium, a calcium supplement. And they should also, again, as I said, eat plenty of these vegetables. And I would say that it is probably a good idea that they have extra fiber. It's very difficult in our day and age to sit down and eat enough vegetables to provide, you know, plenty of fiber.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so much easier to take a fiber supplement. And the whole problem with regard to the gut and cancer is very slow transit times allow the food, which has been broken down, to sit there, and then that allows bad bacteria to ferment. And it's probably the production chemicals from these bad bacteria and, you know, basically rotting of the food in the gut that causes this problem with the cancer. But if you increase the transit time,
And for transit time, you're meaning the time that it takes for it to pass through your stomach to come out.
Right. The longer that takes, the worse it is on your system in many different ways. For one thing, again, it's just the physical factor of that food sitting there for a long time in the gut, in the colon. The other thing is it allows for bad bacteria to develop, and those bad bacteria may generate factors that can be toxic and harmful.
Does it matter the order in which you eat your food? Would you eat meat first or vegetables or fruit?
Well, some would say yes. Eva, it is so difficult to get people to change their diet that to go into great detail with regard to the, you have to do this, you have to do that right away, for instance, with my patient, tends to overwhelm them, and you tend to have much less success.
I see.
So, you know, when it comes down to it, have I ever done a study that shows that you should never eat fruit after you've eaten meat? No, I've never done that study, and I haven't noticed in particular that that's been bothersome for some people. While others would maintain that that is going to cause a digestive calamity, I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
What I would think would be more important is to pay attention to some more of these basics. Let's try to get a little bit more fiber in your diet. Let's try to get a little bit more live food into your diet and not so much dead processed food in your diet.
Well, speaking of live food, that made me think of something else. You have so much information, I could pick your brain for days. What about living foods such as sprouts and things?
Very much more beneficial over processed food, yes. very, very, very much more beneficial.
And now that you say processed foods, if you were going to choose between, if you weren't going to have fresh, if you were going to choose between frozen and canned, which would you choose and why?
I would choose fresh frozen because the fresh frozen is still raw, and you can thaw the fresh frozen and then just minimally cook it so that not so much of the nutrients and the enzymes are lost in
okay.
the processing. Now, Eva, I will tell you that for somebody that has a higher risk for colon cancer, there's a test that's done by Great Smoky's lab that they should have done, and that's called a CDSA. That's called a complete digestive stool analysis.
Mm-hmm.
That test has several factors in there which can be looked at to determine whether or not the person has the overgrowth of bad bacteria and the production of bad toxins in the gut, which may lead to problems with colon cancer. And after having that test, a clinician such as myself can then devise a more accurate protocol for a particular patient to reverse those conditions, and then can go back and check to see whether there's been improvement.
So there is a preventive test you can do.
Yes. It's diagnostic, and it also has factors that can help you with your preventive protocol. Another important thing for people at risk for colon cancer is to be sure that they're taking what's called probiotics, and those are live beneficial bacteria to help re-nourish the gut with good bacteria.
And you would find that in yogurts and stuff like that, but not the yogurt. I think that it's not the yogurts like you go and buy Danyon or something, but the kind that actually say live cultures or whatever it says, right?
Live cultures or make the yogurt yourself, even the ones with the live cultures. If they had live cultures and then they pasteurized the yogurt, which is pasteurization is a very high heat type process, they are going to kill those live cultures. And so
they don't tell you that.
Right. But that's what the pasteurization is for, is to kill bacteria so that it slows the fermentation of the food so that the food is preserved, and also so that you're not given an infective bacteria in the food.
So the people that are running out and buying all their Danons and whatever they are really aren't getting what they're thinking they're getting at all, are they?
Not likely.
And what do you think? I'm kind of proactive about organic foods because I believe that if you spray bug spray on your foods and then foods get made from those foods, they're going to have chemicals in them that change your cellular structure. Where if you have organic foods and organic milks and meats, then you won't get those things that's going to cause cancers to begin with, right?
Correct.
So it's important to go and buy organic foods. I mean, so many children nowadays, I believe, you know, having ADHD and overweightness, they're getting chemicals inside their body, and their mothers and daddies thinking they're giving their children such healthy foods by letting them drink a glass of milk every day when really they're getting chemicals.
Correct. Not only that, again, the milk has been pasteurized, and when you pasteurize a food like that, you take it to tremendously high heat. Milk contains protein, and it contains sugar. When you heat protein and carbohydrates together, protein and sugar together, then it causes a Maillard reaction, which is basically caramelization. It fuses the sugar to the protein and makes it very, very difficult to digest properly.
So why people would have problems drinking milk with their stomach?
That can be one of the reasons why, yes.
So if they drank organic milk, it could be different for them?
Well, if they drink unpasteurized milk, fresh, untreated milk, that's completely different than drinking pasteurized milk from the store, yes. Weston Price, Price Pottinger Foundation, has done studies to show that if you feed cats whole fresh milk that's not pasteurized, and you feed a different set of cats pasteurized milk, the cats that are fed the whole fresh milk, unpasteurized, thrive and do very well. The cats that drink the pasteurized milk tend to begin having birth problems, and by the third generation of cats are unable to have live births.
That's amazing.
And so
I can see why it's so important to give your babies organic milks.
Well, it's probably more important that you not because any milk that you buy is going to be pasteurized. It's more important to not give them cow's milk.
Oh, I see. So what should they take?
For one thing, the proteins in cow's milk are too complex for the babies, and they tend to start having reactions to the proteins because of the immune system. The other thing is that whether they have reactions or not, children develop thickened mucus. Their secretions become much more thickened immediately after drinking milk. So they have small eustachian tubes, the tubes that drain the ears to the inside of the throat.
Okay. No wonder so many babies have ear tube problems.
So the babies drink the cow's milk. It thickens their secretions. The secretions bind in the eustachian tube and back up into the middle ear. And then anytime you have a diminished flow in the body from someplace that's supposed to drain, then you have the chance for bacteria to overgrow, and then that's how they develop their infections.
That's amazing.
And so just taking babies off of cow's milk can oftentimes reduce the incidence of ear infections and those types of problems.
So what should they take?
Well, what should they do? They should breastfeed the baby. The baby should be drinking mama's own milk for the first year or two of life.
When my babies got through formulas, the first thing my doctor said was start giving them milk now. Mm-hmm. So now that we know we shouldn't do that, when they come off the formulas or the breast milk, what should they be giving them?
Well, rice milk has a very low allergenic property and has generally been fortified with, if you buy the right brand, has been fortified with calcium and maybe even iron. And mm-hmm. so it's much more beneficial and much less risky to give your child than cow's milk.
Okay.
Rice milk has the same amount of nutrients. What they want the kids to have the milk for is the calcium, and there's just as much calcium because they fortify them in rice milk. Another alternative would be soy milk, but we don't recommend that they give soy exclusively to their children because soy is high up there on the list of allergens for children. And also, soy can have it can have an estrogenizing effect.
What do you mean by that?
Well, estrogen is a hormone produced by female ovaries and in small amounts in men. And you don't want to give babies a large. You don't want to have estrogen. You don't want to have the estrogen effect in babies or children because they're not prepared for those changes as yet.
Right.
And
well, that brings up another question. Why do you suppose so many young girls nowadays are developing breasts way too early? Is it hormones and meat?
And in milk products, and in chicken, yes, they use growth hormone and they use estrogens to cause rapid production of weight gain in these animals.
So, would organic meats take care of that problem?
They should.
Okay.
When you talk about meat, in the case of beef, consider the fact, Eva, that at the turn of the century, people were eating a meat-based diet, a beef-based diet frequently, and you didn't have heart disease and arthritis and all that the way that we do now. The reason is because the beef that they ate was range-fed. there were no hormones in it, and there was no corn fed to the beef. The beef ate grass. That beef is high in a beneficial fat called omega-3 fatty acids. The omega-3 fatty acids, again, those are another thing that we put patients that have heart disease or high blood pressure or diabetes on, because the omega-3 fatty acids are necessary for the body's normal functions, especially the cell wall function, and just every function you can imagine are related to these proper fatty acids. People now, however, eat food or beef that is grain-fed. The grain-fed beef does not have the omega-3 fatty acid in it. In fact, it has more arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid is a pro-inflammatory acid. It is necessary for proper brain and eye development as a child, but if you get a predominance of arachidonic acid and don't get some of these other good omega-3 fatty acids, then you have an overproduction of inflammation and an underproduction of beneficial aspects in the body, and that can lead to major health problems. And that's why people now, from eating the fatty meat that we have, develop health problems related to obesity and heart disease and blood pressure problems, et cetera, et cetera. It's because the nature of the meat has been changed because of the way that the animals are fed.
That makes so much sense. What about women? Because almost every woman I know has something going on with her uterus, endometriosis or fibroids or cysts. What would you recommend for that?
Well, again, that generally comes from a predominance of estrogen production and in relationship to progesterone. You know, the body is really big on balance. It likes balance in these things, not too much of this, not too much of that. And what happens is that women, again, are eating this diet that's high in bad fats and low in good fats. And that generally tends to cause, and also the beef and milk and those types of things contain more estrogen-type foods. The bad fats cause an increased production in inflammatory products, and that leads to more endometriosis and uterine fibroid development and growth. And also, women have higher production of estrogen relative to progesterone. So they're coming to menopause earlier, and estrogen and a lack of progesterone stimulates the production of endometriosis and stimulates the production of the fibroids. So what I recommend, we do hormone testing on women that come to us with those problems, and then we generally will place them on some type of progesterone supplementation, and depending on where they are, premenopause or postmenopause, may do some nutritional supplementation or whatever to adjust those or modulate the estrogen production. We're tending to shy away from giving just outright hormone replacement therapy with estrogen because there are many women that if you do genomic testing, you can actually test their genetic profiling and see how they metabolize estrogen. There are many women that are at great risk for cancer production because of the particular way they metabolize estrogen. Estrogen is metabolized or broken down by the body into several byproducts. Some of the byproducts are very pro-cancer, and some of the byproducts are very anti-cancer, and determining the way a particular woman breaks down these estrogen breaks down into these estrogen byproducts can tell you whether or not she's at great risk for developing cancer from estrogen replacement therapy, and that includes birth control pills. So what we do is we look at the patient as a whole, and again we get back to diet and we try to reduce the fats in the diet and reduce the consumption of the bad carbohydrates, and we tried to instill some of the good fats back into the diet in the manner of fish oil. We place these ladies on vitamin E, vitamin B6, EPA and fish oil capsules, and also may do some progesterone replacement therapy. And generally, they will see a reversal in their problems with endometriosis and with fibroids. And again, it's where you find a lady. If she's bleeding to death from the fibroids and they're wanting to take her uterus out, you may not have time because a nutritional approach will take some time to allow the body to heal. We're talking mm-hmm. months. Well, you may not have time if somebody's bleeding out and they've waited too late to come to you.
That was the next question I was going to ask you. Whenever I do readings on people, one of the things that I get, because I read in advance, I can read in advance in years to come. When your bleeding pattern changes, is it indicative that something's trying to tell you something?
Yes.
If it goes from normal periods and you start slightly increasing that bleeding pattern, your uterus is telling you I'm getting sick, right?
Yes, that needs to be looked into.
Okay.
Very definitely.
Now, we got a few more minutes, and I want to touch on something that I don't know if you've worked on or not, but I feel very strongly about it, and that's receptors. So many of our kids today are being diagnosed with ADHD and ADD, and I don't know why, because who am I to even make an assumption about anything? I'm just a woman, have no medical training, but I am thoroughly convinced that those kinds of things and those fast-growing brain tumors or firing issues may be caused by artificial electromagnetic energy. I just don't believe that our bodies were meant to be exposed to as much artificial energy as we're being exposed to. Do you have any insight on that?
Well, as far as ADD and ADHD, I mean, that's nobody has found a specific thing that in 100% of these kids causes the problem. Each individual has to be taken at from where they're coming from and has to be evaluated in that right. And your explanation with regard to energy is as good as any of the others that are out there. My approach is a more physical type approach, and I do think that there are receptor problems, neuroreceptor problems with these children, and that ADHD and ADD can be caused by physical problems out there. One thing can be metal toxicity, mercury or lead,
mm-hmm.
Very commonly found in elevated levels in these children. Another thing can be just a problem with neurotransmitters. Again, diet and all plays a role in this, but one can obtain urine samples and send urine samples, for instance, to a lab called Neuroscience, and they can test for basic neurotransmitters that have everything to do with how well your brain is functioning. And in correcting imbalances in the neurotransmitters, you can find that many of these children will improve. There have been studies that have shown that in autism, for instance, many of these children have very high levels of a narcotic-type compound that is correlated to their ingestion of milk products.
Really?
And by reducing their ingestion of dairy products, they can have a reduction in this narcotic-type compound, and many of them will come out of their cloud somewhat.
Really?
Yes.
That's amazing.
So there are many factors, nutritional. Some people would link ADHD and ADD to and autism to the exposure to mercury that are obtained in vaccinations. Some would link them to allergies. Food allergies, for instance, can contribute to the problem. And it tends to be a multifactorial problem. And, you know, the situation that you're talking about, being bombarded with electromagnetic fields, you know, me as a common guy, I just have no way to measure that. I have no idea when I'm walking through electromagnetic field that may be what is bothering me. And, you know, I'm talking to you right now on a phone, and goodness knows what kind of electromagnetic field that's set up around my ear and that side of my brain.
Well,
I have no way of measuring that and have no way of knowing what that is. Well, in medicine, if we can't measure something like that, guess what we do?
Ignore it.
Very, very intelligent reaction. Yeah, we ignore it.
Well, you know, we have so many more glioblastomas and those type of cancers in the brain that just go like wildfire. And I'm convinced that the first thing that you do when somebody gets a cancer of that type or something is to put them in an MRI. Well, that just feeds it and it takes off like wildfire. Do you not think if you could use a product like Ambertose, the glyconutrients, and build back those receptors so the brain can actually talk or the cells can actually talk to one another, no matter what your disease, that it would be better?
Well, I have no idea. I have no idea.
I mean, it sounds to me like you would be, the cells would be like two people talking on a telephone with great static eruption in the middle of it, and how could they possibly get the message across? It just seems logical to me if you would build back your receptors or stop, if you're having significant problems in your head, epilepsy or any other kind of firing issue, or in your autonomic nervous system as a whole, if you are around strong electromagnetic fields. There's so many nuclear plants now and atomic plants now that you would get better.
Right.
Does that make any sense?
You know what? I just don't have enough information to know if it makes sense.
Okay.
I don't know. Again, we're talking about something that's not measurable. And
have you not seen an increase, though, in the last decade or two? Now, I mean, isn't it ironic that we have so many more of those kinds of cancers that go like wildfire at the same time that we have so many more electromagnetic products?
Well, what I've seen is a general decline in health and a general decline in the people's ability to mount an immune response against any particular invading disease, and cancer being one of those.
Well, immune response, I'm going to have time for one more question now. That brings up one more question in my head. When we were kids, we were jumping up and down and hanging upside down from trees and jump rope and whatever. We don't do that anymore. So I get in some of my readings that the people's limp settles, and I'll say, do you have tenderness under your arm or in your breast? And they'll say, yes. If they were to do more vertical exercise up and down, wouldn't that stimulate that immune system so it's not clogged up? So that they could fight disease more?
Yes, and they can also do massage, skin massage and lymphatic massage. That would help that as well as far as reversing that stasis that you're speaking of.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much. Promise me you'll come back again, because now you've elicited a million more questions in my head that I know I'd love to ask you.
Well, write them down, and I'll answer them another time.
Thank you so much again. And tell me your phone number again for anybody that wants to call you.
941-488-8112 is the office phone.
Thank you so much, Matthew, and agape, my friend.
My pleasure. Thank you, Eva.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to a Blog In Broadcasting service, a service to others' endeavor. Thank you very much, and good night.